Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. This is the full interview between Dr. Brian Cox and Charles Jenks, produced by our magical friends at Yada Yada. Here's how they got on.
I'm with Charles Jenks, who's a landscape designer and writer, and has said that modern science is perhaps the best impetus for creativity in art. And you use that, of course, in your latest book to design a wonderful garden. Could you guide us through the garden? Take us on a walk through the Garden of Cosmic Speculation.
Basically, the garden is in southern Scotland in the Borders area, and it's about 30 acres near a river called the Nith. Water flows through the garden naturally, so we've used it to create different spaces. The center focuses on a cascade called the Universe Cascade, down which water cascades every so often when we turn it on, and up which people walk, and it shows the history of the universe over 13.7 billion years, which is what scientists tell us it is. So I've tried to dramatize that walk as a series of jumps. You climb up the steps, and each 5 or 6 or 10 steps you have a new period of history. You start off in the mud, you start off in the water, you start off in mist, and you end up, you know, in mist. You don't know what is at the origin of the universe, but you know there was you think there's an inflationary period, so the steps inflate, and then you go through these jumps. And, you know, the jump into life is a symmetry break, in a sense. The jump when the four forces, earlier, when the four forces froze out. So the metaphor I use for the universe is a jumping universe. That is, I'm in this cascade, I'm showing the leaps of organization. And the idea is that the universe is always getting more interesting as it's unfolding through symmetry breaking. Well, that's the heart of the garden. And then around it are a series of other areas which explore things like the black hole, genes, quarks, the ultimate particles that you're investigating.
What I find very interesting about the Garden of Cosmic Speculation is this idea that you're not just trying to represent the discoveries of science in some way. You're really trying to play a role in certainly in the dialogue science has with culture and with the wider culture, I suppose. You're trying to add, right? You're not just representing.
No, I'm trying to present as well as represent. I think that, for instance, the Black Hole Terrace, where we have dinner on the Black Hole Terrace, and you sink into the ground without the terrace. So it was as a, you know, a functional reason for being a terrace. The thing is to present gravity. You fall into it. You spin. It's a representation of what would happen if you fell into a black hole. You'd be spaghettified, as the scientists tell us, as you tell us. So I've used that metaphor in part, speculated as you indeed have, that there may be a connection of black holes to other universes, to time travel, and so forth. But my view is that you have to, when I'm working, it's always a double design. I have to make a thing work. It has to function as a terrace for food and so on, as a view. And then I have to look at what science is saying is the image, and then translate that into a new image. In other words, I can't just leave it as, it's not a form of just representing what scientists say. It's a presentation of the feeling of the thing, and then a comment on it. So yes, I don't leave things alone. Yes, I criticize scientists, but I also follow their lead. In other words, I accept that it's scientists are giving us the brute insight into nature and the laws of nature, but aren't maybe the best people to tell us what it means and how we should feel about it. I don't think scientists have the best culture for doing that, and I don't think religious discourse does either. And I don't think anyone does, frankly. I think that culture is a ongoing discussion about what really matters, both to us and to the universe. And so I'm sort of fascinated by the way that in CERN here in Switzerland, you are going to be probing very, very soon the basic questions again, and looking for this particle named after Mr. Higgs in Edinburgh, near where I've created this garden, and I see in CERN two kinds of architecture. There's the framework of the standard model, which is a form of conceptual architecture, rather than thrown together building, if I can make the distinction between building and architecture. Architecture is the idea that the logic and the simplicity and the beauty are naturally likely to come together. Sometimes you discover things that are ugly, unnecessary, and no one asked for. But often you discover things because it's the simplest, most elegant, and it's entailed by either the maths or the geometry or some symmetry, isn't it? Isn't that the case? So that both happen.
I think that's right. It's often put forward as one of the deepest mysteries in science, at some level, is why mathematics describes the universe. One of the potential explanations is, I think, as you've said, that what it really is, math, is a codification of symmetry. It allows you to think in a logical way. And the universe appears to be built that way. So it's not in a sense that the universe is mathematical. It's that mathematics is a guide to allow you to think in that.
It's a language. Well, I mean, architecture, in its deepest sense, has always been about that. And Vitruvius in the first century BC wrote the treatise that survives, and he said, a good architect has to study various things, semiotics, the theory of science. And then he said, cosmology. And he said, the fact that we revolve around the sun, interesting, Vitruvius and early Roman architects felt that. And he said, you really have to understand the universe before you can design a building. In effect, that's always been deep in the architectural profession. I mean, architects are here to represent what you tell us is the nature of nature. And I think that's the fun of a garden. I mean, because gardens are very messy things, and they have hard work. But you're right there in nature, and sometimes it improves what you're doing, what you're building. It can build it better for you. Other times, it can drive you to distraction because it doesn't want to do what you want it to do. But in the end, making a garden is using nature to think about nature.
This is what I find particularly attractive, actually, about your book, because as someone who not only works at CERN but also tries to speak about science to the wider culture, I think it's very important, not only for the reason of funding, but just important in general. I find that focus on getting the framing right, this kind of George Lakoff-type idea, I suppose, of his ideas of framing arguments in the right way. I absolutely accept that, and I've learned something by reading your writing about that. I wonder, nature, though, I mean, I would still argue that reductionism, and I know this is unfashionable, and you would say, well, you're a dumb scientist and you don't know about the trends in philosophy and literature. Reductionism still, to me, seems to be, experimentally, not for any philosophical reason, the best way of finding out how the universe works. So I'd like to take you now to the temple of reductionism, maybe the last temple of reductionism, which is my experiment, Atlas. We're at one of the ends of the Atlas detector, and what we can see is the forward muon wheel, so the big golden muon detectors, 20 metres in diameter, to get some sense. It's an astounding structure.
Now, this is really very beautiful, isn't it? And I think a direct expression of the forces of movement, are they? Those end panels of the measuring the muon, is that?
Yeah, they measure muons.
And you know, we call it, there's a movement in the art world called indexical art, where the index of what's happening creates the work itself, or iconic. It's also known in another way as iconic, because the icon, the image, comes out of the process, and it's fairly direct here, isn't it?
Yep, and one thing you can say, actually, is the size of the thing. It's not been built this big because this is how much money we had. It's this big because the energies of the particles that you want to contain in order to measure dictate how big the thing has to be. The more energetic the collisions, the bigger the thing has to be to contain it and therefore measure it. And it's that this energy, because the Higgs and the things that we don't know about are at this energy.
Well,
the size is driven by nature.
So a previous measurement of muons would be, say, two-thirds of that size, previous accelerator?
Yep. So if you go to the accelerators at Fermilab in Chicago, which are seven times less energy, then
you know, pretty much the detectors are 7 times smaller.
This reminds me very much of the plan in the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries of ideal cities in Italy. I don't know if you've ever seen them, where they are on the outside regular polyhedra, like a hexagon or an octagon, and then on the inside a circle. And of course you find the church and the palace the central square in the center, and then all the on these radiating avenues you find the inner buildings have the public buildings and the outer ones have the people living. And so it's like a defensive city, ideal city, by a man named Scamozzi in about 1660, laid out the plan of your muon detector. You might look at it.
I wonder if he knew. If he had any inkling.
He was before his time. But you know, I mean, it is like a city in a way, isn't it, too? Because all of those micro elements are like little streets and, you know, houses. And
what you can see there, those pipes carry the gas into muon chambers. Muon chambers are full of gas, which is how they work.
It's certainly a mystery, isn't it? Because every time I hear it explained, how could emptiness be full of particles that come in and out of existence in microseconds? I go away saying, oh, yes, I understand. And then 30 seconds later, I say, what? You can try.
I think the point, what quantum mechanics taught us, and it's a very mature theory now, it's 80, 90 years old, right, is that anything that can happen will happen. If you've got energy, then it can crystallize into particles, matter and antimatter, and then it'll disappear again. And because it can, it does. And so that's the thing. As long as you've got energy, in fact, well, you don't even need energy because you can borrow it. So quantum mechanics even allows you to borrow energy for a short amount of time.
In a short amount of time. But yes, I know, but it sounds rather mysterious to say that, because it sounds awfully much like ether in the night. If you're saying that emptiness is full of nothing and that nothing jumps into and out of existence in split microseconds, it sounds, first of all, like ether, that in fact nothingness is full of potential somethingness all the time. Everywhere there's the universe. So, you know, it does sound like we've heard it before, and it sounds mysterious. And that reminds us that the heart of everything is a mystery, which is precisely what classical religions have claimed, in a way, except they've claimed to know what the mystery is, which is you don't claim to know what the mystery is, but you still claim, or, I mean, maybe you don't claim it's a mystery. You just say that anything that can happen does happen.
One of the interesting things, I think, that I got from reading your book, it's something that I really firmly believe, that being a scientist, you walk a tightrope between being an engineer, in a way, a reductionist, I suppose, and having a sense of awe, which is and wonder at the universe, which is the thing that drives you to be a scientist in the first place. And it's very easy to forget one or the other. Saying things are mysterious is, to me, not a very scientific response, because then you essentially throw up your hands and say, well, it's mysterious, and I wouldn't want to advocate that position. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that if you lose your sense of awe or fail to convey the sense of awe to people that you're talking to about science, and you make it all too mechanistic, then you've lost a lot. In fact, you've lost your humanity. You've lost the reason that you want to do it in the first place. But quantum mechanics, I always emphasize this, what it really is the theory of how things move around. I mean, it's absolutely prosaic in that sense. It's a theory of how electrons get from one place to the other. That's why it's called mechanics. I mean, the fact that it has these bizarre properties is mysterious, but then there is a tendency often to, I think, to over-dramatize how mysterious it is. Although I'm aware of the fact there are very eminent physicists that say that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you're missing something. But that's what it is, actually. It allows you to calculate how things move around.
Yes, I understand it does. But it still has propositions which, if we translate into our human terms, are either absurd or contradictory, because they don't translate ordinarily. It's mysterious in two senses, in the sense that it is not like our normal life, to say you and I don't pop in and out of existence in a microsecond, and things aren't and are. That's not our kind of existence. So in terms of our common existence, it's mysterious. I think that there's no question that that's true. And in the other way it's a mystery is that we don't fully understand why it should be the case. So I see, you know, the the idea that the universe starts off in a kind of unfathomable fog, and maybe we'll never get back to the origin of the universe. A lot of people say that, because when you go back to a certain closeness to the origin, you inevitably lose the ability to calculate. And maybe, theoretically, I guess you can't ever calculate what the origin was. All you can do is infer a whole lot of stuff. And therefore, I mean, the origin may forever be hidden from us.
What it's true to say, though, is that this thing, Atlas, in the LHC, has a chance, particularly if there are extra dimensions in the universe, has a chance of showing us the way to a quantum theory of gravity. It's a very slim chance, actually, everyone would admit, but it has a chance. And so a quantum theory of gravity is the minimum you need to be able to calculate in those extreme conditions, in the Big Bang or in the centre of a black hole. But if you've got a quantum theory of gravity, you have a chance. So this is the next step.
Okay, so how would we see an extra dimension or several?
You can see it in several ways. One is to create mini black holes in this experiment. And that would mean that there are extra dimensions, because it would require gravity as a force to become as strong as the other three forces that we observe in here. Strong force, the weak force, and electromagnetism. The only way that gravity can become as strong as those, anything like the energy we can generate with the LHC, is if there are extra dimensions in the universe, paradoxically. So a black hole will be a signature of extra dimensions.
It would be warped together, you mean?
The picture is that the extra dimensions, one reason you can't see them if they exist is because they're small. And literally, in the space in front of you, there could be extra dimensions that are rolled up. And if they're rolled up smaller than the wavelength of visible light, then your eyes wouldn't see them, right? Visible light wouldn't see them. And one way of looking at high-energy particle physics experiments like this is that energy corresponds to wavelength. And the more energy you've got, the smaller the wavelength is. So in a sense, you could just end up seeing these extra dimensions because you've got the resolving power. You've got the energy to open them up.
And how many extra dimensions would you... What would be...
How many do I want? Well, I'm told by my string theorist friends that 11's good, so that would be 7 extra ones. Although, it has to be underlined that that's speculative stuff. Right, I mean, we're very much more at I don't know. We're in a more real world with Atlas and the LHC. You know, we really are at the place where experiments... We're at the frontier of experiment here. And really, science is experimental. It's theoretical in the sense that you can speculate, and there are many theories about quantum gravity because we have no experimental evidence one way or the other. So they grow, which is a good thing in a way. But at some point, it's like a hedge, right? It needs trimming back. And this is a hedge trimmer, if ever there was one.
Well, I understand it's been a long research, and 40 years you've had the standard model, is that right? About the 60s. This is the culmination of the standard model. So we're looking at, if we think of it as a cathedral, there were 40 years of building cathedrals in the classic period, in the Ile-de-France, and it starts off, you know, in Saint-Denis, and then it ends up in Beauvais, and Beauvais fell down, as you may know, because they built it too high and they pushed it, the envelope, too far. So I don't know if you know that, but there is a... I mean, as an accelerator, have you reached the limit here? Is this the Beauvais of accelerators? You can't go any further without the weight being too much, the cost being too much, et cetera, et cetera. Will there be one after this?
There is certainly a plan to build one after this, called the International Linear Collider. And it's a different machine. It collides, or it's hoped it will collide, electrons and anti-electrons. And electron-anti-electron colliders are much cleaner than proton-proton colliders, but they operate at a lower energy. So we can get more energy into protons than we can into electrons. So the idea would be, though, that we need to discover something that we need to observe with high precision with this machine. And if we do that, then we need to find out what it is that we've discovered, and that may well require the next generation of machine. But in a sense, you don't really know how to build it or how big you need it, because you don't know what there is waiting around the corner.
But this is 27 kilometers, am I right, in a circle?
Yeah.
Is it an absolute circle?
No, it's got straight bits and curved bits.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you accelerate things up to near the speed of light,
yeah.
two protons, is that right? And then you aim them at each other and they hit them. Now, there was a super collider in Texas, which was never built, and how that was going to be much bigger,
yeah,
wasn't it?
50 or so, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, and I wonder, what I'm really asking is that this model is more or less as big as this type of circular collider will get. They're not going to construct another one larger than 27 kilometers.
In many ways, this machine has been built to discover the Higgs, and I say that with inverted commas around it, right? Because obviously we don't know. The standard model includes a Higgs particle. Without the Higgs particle, the standard model is unable to predict anything at this energy. So the way the argument goes is we either discover the Higgs or we discover what does its job, because the standard model falls to bits at LHC energies without a Higgs in it. I just should say that the Higgs raises, a single Higgs particle raises probably as many questions as it solves. Now, so in a way, the worst thing that could happen, and it would be a tremendous achievement, but the worst thing is you discover a Higgs and it sits there and the standard model then behaves itself and you don't get any clue as to what comes next. It would require immense fine-tuning, actually, which is something that physicists don't like. It would require a lot of numbers being tuned to very high precision, to balanced, if you want, to make the standard model with a single Higgs particle work, which is why a lot of theorists prefer supersymmetry and supersymmetric models, because they provide, they're more natural in many ways, and also provide a candidate for dark matter, which is another big mystery in the universe.
Well, there's two kinds of architecture here, it seems to me. There's conceptual architecture, which is a framework for thinking about the universe. And architects love, you know, since the beginning, have been saying the universe is this way, therefore architecture should be a reflection of it. So here you've got a particle accelerator measuring a theory, the standard model. And the theory is itself a piece of architecture, and a beautiful one, isn't it? Because it's been tested for 40 years. You've spent maybe £25 billion over that 40 years or more in light of a theory of architecture, if you'll excuse me. And so here we have a theory, which is a piece of architecture, and you've got a piece of hardware architecture to find to prove the theory. And in that sense, it's not unlike the cathedrals of France, which were trying to prove their theories of how the universe was, or in different periods of architecture. The same relationship between a theory of the universe and the architecture that reflects it, measures it, celebrates it, and collapses when it's...
I think there's a profound difference, right? And the profound difference is that, honestly, we're not trying to prove it, we're trying to break it.
And no, really, but you have a hypothesis that the Higgs exists or doesn't exist.
To break it.
Yes, but you have the faith in the standard model, the faith of spending £25 billion of our money, and if you didn't have the faith that it was there, and the faith is kept by the standard model. The structure of the standard model is a conceptual piece of architecture. Conceptual architecture. No standard model, no £25 billion. You can't get it out of us.
But it's surely different, though, to as you said, the analogy with the cathedral. Because the cathedral, indeed, I'm sure that they're built to reinforce a particular worldview.
That's how you look at the cathedrals. Wait a minute. Don't condescend too quickly to the 13th century. They believed it was true. They weren't just, it wasn't all ideology. They weren't trying to force it down the people's throats. So, you know, they had theories. Aquinas had theories. They may be false. Of course they're false in many ways. But I don't think we should say it was, just pure ideology. They really believed it. And it would be absurd to say that they didn't. And they thought, you know, the cathedrals were, like, the Egyptians had crazy ideas, too, of pharaonic long life and the people living to the pharaoh. But they really believed it. It wasn't all ideology. We when you look at the past, it all looks phony. And we may, no, that's true. There's nothing like the rearview mirror view to think that they were all paid, you know, by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Pentagon, which spends about the same amount of money on a theory of war on terror. So you can say, go ahead.
I was going to say, though, that to me a cathedral is built to reinforce a worldview, right? The architecture is built, it's a thing that's designed to reinforce a view of the world, whereas this is something that's built to tear down a view of the world. That's what we hope will happen with this machine.
No, I think that you're more sophisticated, and we are more sophisticated because we come after a dogmatic period of what the universe is, and science, after learning not to put pin its hopes too soon on the tail of the donkey, has gotten wiser. But still you have standard models, you have standard dogmas. You say that you want to disprove the Higgs or find something more than the Higgs, but it's also the Higgs which motivates you. It's your, you know, the Holy Ghost of your grail.
I see what it is politically.
I mean, okay, I admit that there's a difference between raising the $25 billion and what you're doing as a theoretical scientist and as a human being. I'm not saying you personally aren't motivated by the curiosity and the will to discover. But I'm saying socially, in a way, your dogma, it's like the standard dogma of DNA, you know, which is that DNA only goes one way, which was through Crick and Watson. That was standard dogma. It never goes the other way. It's not Lamarck, right? And they called it standard dogma. Okay, now we know it isn't altogether true. But you have your standard dogmas, and without those standard dogmas, you don't get PhDs, you don't stay in the universe, you don't get ahead. You can't, there's certain things you cannot get a university degree for if you want to challenge these standard dogmas. And I mean, you only have to know the sociology of science to know that that's true. So I will agree that there's a difference between the cathedrals and this building. I agree with you. But there are also a lot of similarities, and one of the most important one is this notion that through an architecture of the mind, of a framework of thinking about the universe, you have arrived at an end result view of what things might be. And this building is going to test that. But you have a great hunch that even if you don't find exactly what you're looking for, you will find its equivalent, which will keep you pushing forward.
There's a way of thinking about the Higgs and the Standard Model, which is that the Standard Model breaks down energies below those at which we collide protons together at the LHC, right? And it breaks down in a very specific way, and that's where you want to be as a scientist. You want to be at the place where your knowledge finishes and the model collapses. The Higgs is the simplest way we've thought of as plugging the hole, right? And so in that sense, you might expect it to turn up. But it surely is a theory, and it just happens to be the simplest that we can think of. And science, often, simplicity is a guide to truth for some reason in the universe.
Often it is. Right.
But it is important to point out that the reason we're here and the reason we go into that energy is because we know exactly where the hole is. And it may be a Higgs-shaped hole, or it may not be.
Sure.
As someone who takes inspiration from science, is it a problem that science can just move? They can not even move, but there can be a revolution, and then your garden suddenly becomes an obsolete, frozen relic.
Well, yes, I think that can happen, and then, you know, when we find out there's a mistake, it dates the garden precisely to the time when they thought that theory, which is false. So I agree that, you know, false things are built into the garden, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, all the theories are false in the sense we learn their limits. The challenge is to keep up with the change. So when you build a mistake in concrete, as I have done from time to time, Roger Penrose asked me this very question. What are you going to do when all of this rubbish about superstrings is disproved? Aren't you going to be embarrassed? And I said, no, it'll just date precisely that part of the garden.
The problem with the rubbish about superstrings, of course, is it can't be disproved. That's most people's objection.
Well, a few hundred years, maybe.
Charles, what's your response to the last bastion of reductionism?
Well, it's fantastic. It's heroic. It's very funny, too, that in the Swiss beautiful landscape with the mountains and nature around you with water and greenery and just staggering beauty, you go like a mole into this hole in the ground, 100 meters down. You go through a concrete barracks with all this incredibly unaesthetic ugliness to discover down there in a tunnel in your hole fundamental truths about the universe and maybe getting us right up against the origin of the universe. I think this is on a human level, this is very funny, isn't it, that culture for 20 or 30,000 years has been going down holes, dark holes, looking at nature. You've built an underground cathedral. It's beautiful in some ways. It's a mess in others. It's fun to go to. I can see that it...
You're welcome to come and landscape it.
Well, I would think, in a funny way, if you landscaped it, in certain ways, yes, you could make it really beautiful too. And the contrast, there are churches, maybe you haven't seen them, the Baroques and Rococo churches in southern Bavaria, where the outside is severe, boring, ugly, and the inside is incredibly interesting and intricate and subtle. So, I'm not saying that you should feature that, because I think the intensity of what you do would be spoiled if you tried to tart it up or you made it anything it isn't. So one likes it for being direct and innocent in a way. You're just measuring thing, and everything that I look at is a consequence of you trying to measure things and do a direct job. And that has that kind of direct honesty about it, which would be spoiled by too many landscape architects like me messing it around.
Well, thanks, Charles. It's been a real pleasure.
Guardian Unlimited.